you know how dumb that sounds? It's when the time you get into the market, your timing of the market. My grandpa bought a house for $12,000. And it, you know, I don't say, well, I'm waiting until it goes back to 12. I'm not buying a house until they go back to $12,000. I'm not doing it. Why should I have to pay more than he does? What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore, with my co-host, Jake Sheehy.
Yes, sir.
Whiskey Wednesday.
Yes, sir. Great day. Great day to be alive.
Great day to be alive.
Yes, sir.
You said you didn't get a lot of sleep last night.
Terrible, man. Huh? Terrible sleep last night, but we're happy to be here.
We're going
to
see how you operate.
I'm going to perform. I'm going to perform under stress right now.
Not on a full tank of gas.
Yes, sir, but I'm ready. We're going to hit the gas. We're going to feel good. We got some great stuff.
We're not going to let the audience know. We're going to see if they can even tell. I made it even harder on you because now I threw the gauntlet down as a challenge. Let's see how we battle through this.
Hey, it's going to be easy, man. This is not a problem at all. We got this. We got some trending topics and three really good educational stuff. All right.
Okay. What do we got?
First trending topic, we're going to go Mamdani. He just won the New York City mayoral race. Big news there. How is that going to affect the housing market? And of course, we got an update. Government shutdown, airline travel, holidays coming up, big stuff there. Then we're going right into short-term rental. Things in housing market. So first and foremost, three things that is keeping your short-term rental from not making you the money you would hope for. Okay, first thing. Second thing, real estate overview. We're going to go over the turnover rate. We're going to go over renters versus homeowners, their net worth, you know, which is better. What should you do? And then the third, we're going to dive into the regulations of short-term rentals. You know, if someone buys a property in the wrong spot, what does that look like? But first, Mamdani, he won. Now, there's some people a little weary because he came out with this video, in case people don't know, and he was going over some of his things about how maybe he needs a little bit more money or whatever's happening. And he said, if landlords, you know, are becoming more difficult or the housing isn't right, the government's going to seize that building.
Yeah.
And it makes people a little worried about how that could affect the New York housing situation, right? Is that kind of the thought process on it?
Yeah. So it's yes, and we don't get too political. Outside of absolutely, you should pay attention to politics because of rules, regulations, licensing, permitting, all that stuff. We're in the real estate business, investors, and those are things you better be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. So we talk about them a little bit, and this is a good case study. I don't know if I would call it good. I don't know if good's the right term. A case study on how this is going to shake out for housing, because you know, this was New York was, along with San Francisco, a couple of years ago, came out and said no more short-term rentals. Mm-hmm. We're going to take them off Airbnb. We're going to raise all the, you know, it's hurting our housing costs and cost of housing and renters. Mm-hmm. It's making it to where our residents can't get any more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. Blah blah blah. That's their reason for it. They pulled it off, and guess what happened to housing prices?
What?
They went up.
Yeah,
renters prices went up. So it doesn't, a lot of times these very highly regulated types of policies, they don't necessarily sound good.
Right.
A lot of times they don't work out that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of, I'm a capitalist at heart.
Right.
I believe that the free markets are going to take care of themselves. I think you're going to have more competitive pricing. You're going to have better living situations. Mm. You know, he's talking about a number of different things. What he's talking about is eminent domain. And eminent domain is something where the government can come in and pay you what they deem fair market value for a property if they need it for something. It's typically to build freeways and roads and things like that.
Okay.
And so they will come in and say, hey, listen, we need this new off ramp, or we need a freeway here. We need a new belt route or something. And they will actually go in and they go in and say, hey, listen, we're going to impose eminent domain, which means you're going to lose your property. We're going to pay you for it. And sometimes it's not favorable pricing. Sometimes it is. It doesn't mean it's bad, but he's kind of threatening that. I don't know if he has the ability to do that, but he's also saying, hey, listen, we're not just going to have rent controls. A lot of these big cities have rent controls.
Mm.
It's why you have slumlords, though.
Right.
It's why a lot of these areas have really bad living conditions. Mm. And so they bitch about the living conditions. They bitch about having more affordable housing, yet there's no incentive for the investor to come in and be able to make any money on it, to improve properties, improve living conditions, all that stuff, and then compete with each other because You know, I mean, we're in a competitive business mm-hmm. with short-term rentals. We don't typically work with long-term rentals, and we're talking a little bit more about that right now. Mm-hmm. But if, like, when, like, we always tell everybody, you got to give the consumer a reason to pay you more. If not, you got to drop your price. You mm-hmm. got to be competitive, right? When mm-hmm. somebody else has something similar, the prices come down, and it's better for the consumer.
Mm.
And so, overall, okay. when you have not even rent controls and you fix rent prices and you say, we're not, you can't ever raise rates. Yeah. on a renter, and they're fixed prices, you can't charge more than X amount, there's no incentive for the investor to go in and improve a property. So if the leaky toilets happen, or you need a painted, you know, it's getting really dirty and it needs to be cleaned, or it needs to be painted, or the carpet's bad, what's the incentive for the investor to go do that? Pretty much none, because they can't recoup that money from the investment that they're going to put in by improving the property, improving living conditions. Doesn't necessarily mean rents always go up because in a competitive environment, typically you will have market rates that are going to be, they're going to be a certain amount. Mm-hmm. Now, we are also talking about areas that are not that affordable in the first place.
Right.
So all these rules and regulations have not made it more affordable to live in these types of areas.
Right.
Now you're coming in with somebody that has way more rules, way more regulations, likely. At least that's what his campaign promise is we're going to make it a lot harder to do business in New York, and we're going to make it a lot harder for investors to come in here and make any money. And it's all great for the people that, apparently at the bottom end of the spectrum who need more affordable housing and everything else. It's not an affordable place to live anyways. So none of that has really worked, in my opinion. I'm really, it'll be interesting to see what he can and can't do with eminent domain and all that stuff. But I mean, we don't invest in certain areas for certain reasons. And people think a lot of times, in fact, I've had comments in our reviews, and I appreciate them. Mm-hmm. When somebody says, hey, listen, like your information on short-term rentals, Sean, but I can't stand listening to you talk about politics.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not, I can agree with that because I'm not very good at following politics. I don't follow it very much outside of policies, and I do pay attention to policies in certain areas, and there are certain areas that get very, very regulated, and we avoid them like the plague as investors. So I am typically going to lean to more conservative regulations, more open regulations that say, hey, listen, we believe in free markets and everything else. Now, there's a place for regulations as well, right? You shouldn't be able to go build apartment complexes anywhere you want. You know, you shouldn't be able to go put a gas station right next to a school or a liquor store right next to a school. There's certain regulations that probably need to be there. And you have certain planning and zoning, you know, in different areas for reasons so that you can have, you know, a nice cohesive community. And those things need to be thought out, and zoning needs to be in place for a lot of different asset classes. But when you flat out come in and say, hey, listen, We're gonna try to be the government, solve all these problems that we're not really probably good at solving. I have a problem with a lot of that.
I'm confused. You're talking about how it's not beneficial if it's rent controlled for the investor to come in and fix those things, but what does it do better for the person who actually has to rent it if the toilet is leaky and the shower's moldy? It's a bad on both ends. I'm sitting here trying to figure out.
I think my opinion is it's worse on both ends. It's worse because there's no incentives. When there's no incentives for an investor to come in and do something, why would they do it?
Right.
Would you go invest in something that you're not going to be able to make money on?
No, but then why would anyone want to live there? So the whole thing just seems backwards. It seems, I don't understand.
It just brings down those areas, in my opinion. So it's why you have slums and projects and things like that. Those are rent controlled districts in the urban centers. And those are, when you go to those areas that are rent controlled, Section 8 housing, government subsidized housing, all that stuff.
Yeah.
They're some of your worst areas to live in any given area. And I'm not a real huge fan of it. I mean, I think that it means well. I think that on the surface, a lot of these types of things many times truly probably mean well. But when you really look at it, how it shakes out, and there's a lot of case studies on all this stuff, just go to a lot of these areas and look and see if it worked. And then when you have somebody like a Mondami come in and says, we're going to even double down and make it, you know, even harder, and we're going to, you know, kind of throw our big gavel down and say, you can't do this, you can't do that, and we're going to make you do it a certain way. If we don't like it, we're going to take your property back. You know, the jury's still out on this, but I don't think that's going to end well for New York. I think that there's just going to be, you're taking away all incentives for an investor or somebody to go spend money in that market and make it better.
Mm, okay. Yeah, that's a tough one. All right. On to number two, government shutdown and airline travel. You know, I've seen some social media videos. It seems crazy, the lines and stuff that are happening. And it seems like maybe some people are finally starting to walk out. But and there was an update, last night? Maybe a couple people are starting to find a bill.
I think they're getting close, right? Yeah. I think that first the FAA came out and said, they're shutting down 4% of all flights are getting canceled.
Yeah.
They said 20 to 40% of the workforce for air traffic controllers on any given day is not showing up for work. They're short-staffed by 20 to 40% on an overworked, overstressed job anyways. And as of last week. I think this week they're anticipating 6% of flights to be canceled by Monday, up to 10% by Friday. The lines are getting really bad. It's a mess. And obviously we're in the vacation home business, the travel business, if you will, hospitality. And many of, how is that affecting our guests? Many of us have built portfolios, which our strategy, our buy box is typically buying portfolios within 2 to 4 hours of major metro areas. So they're drivable destinations.
Right.
So not always necessarily affecting us, but it definitely is going to affect holiday traffic as this goes on. I think Sunday night, 8 Democrats, senators voted to stop the shutdown, move it forward. Mm. I think the White House and I think Johnson, Speaker Johnson, Monday said, "Hey, listen, get back to work. We're going to have a vote on Wednesday to open back up. So maybe by the time people are listening to this, we'll see if it's open back up. I don't know how that. I don't know if it's like an instant fix to airline travel. I'm supposed to be speaking at an event in California in
Walnut Creek at the end of the week,
and I got to travel, and it's going to be. I'm a little nervous about that, you know, because I've got a really short timeline to get in and get out.
Yeah,
and with some of these delays, I'm a little worried. So I think it affects a lot of things. Hopefully, they're getting
fixed.
This. And I don't know within our business of short term rentals, most of our portfolios, most of our, our members' portfolios in the Vodacy family are typically because of how we teach things we want to mitigate some of these things. And not necessarily, we're not thinking airlines are going to get shut down, government shutdowns. We're not planning for that stuff.
Right.
But we are planning for good and bad times economically and everything else. And people are going to drive a little bit more than getting on planes when the budget's a little tighter. And so we always want properties are within 2 to 4 hours of major, metro destinations.
Yeah.
So those are usually our feeder cities and they're drivable anyway.
Right.
So we haven't heard of a lot of our portfolios. My portfolio hasn't been affected at all.
Right.
But I think it's going to be a real pain for some people.
Yeah, especially if you're traveling, that really sucks, especially if you're waiting in those long lines. But you did a great segment there, man. I don't know if you did it subconsciously, but you did a fantastic segment into our first short-term rental question there.
All right.
You know, if somebody's not making the money that they had hoped for, we came out with these three things that keep in mind. So let's go through the first one here. Did you underwrite correctly?
Yeah.
Right? Now, this... Of course, you got to figure out your numbers. You got to know your stuff. I guess my question would be, where do people go wrong with this step? Do they not calculate all the other expenses of fixing or property management? Where do they normally slip when they don't underwrite properly?
Yeah. So one, let's talk about generally. So the three things. When you have a property that's struggling, you are missing one or more of three things.
Okay.
You either didn't buy the right property in the right area, you didn't design it correctly to create a unique experience, and or you didn't and are not marketing it correctly to stand out in the crowd.
Okay.
So you're missing, promise you, you're missing one of those three things. Mm. We've analyzed and underwritten thousands of properties. I do live analysis on properties all the time, and it's almost always one of those three things. Mm. Now, underwriting is tough because there's so many tools that make it really easy to underwrite and that we can sometimes think that we're going to make more money than we're going to make because these tools can't analyze everything that we like to look at in our specific underwriting. So naturally, though, people usually select good properties in good areas. Right. However, that doesn't mean you have the potential to make money. This is where people fall off. Their natural instinct is going to be a good area that people travel to, they're attracted to the property. Other people are probably going to be attracted to it. So they're naturally selecting good properties in good areas.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean, again, that you're going to make money, because depending on the cost of that property versus the money you're going to make, there's a ratio there that needs to be favorable to you and be so that it's an investable property in an investable market. And that's where people miss a lot.
Okay.
Is, hey, listen, I picked a really good property. It's going to be really good. I understand that lots of people are coming here. However, you paid way more than the average dollars that the consumer's spending on individual properties to be able to support it and pay those bills. And so it's understanding what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. We're always looking at really three major things. One, how much is the consumer spending on, is there money dumping into this market? Like, is the consumer overall attracted to this market in general?
Right.
Hey, so we look
and
we'll track back the last 5 years, 7 years, and we'll look at graphs of saying, okay, how much money is being spent? Is it continuing to go up? Because we know that the short-term rental consumer is spending more and more money every single year. So I want to see individual markets going up every single year. So I want to see that.
Okay.
Then I want to see, based on the property type and size that I'm looking at, I want to see how much are those consumers willing to pay on a nightly basis, right? So how much are they for that size of property?
Okay.
For a four-bedroom property, how much is the consumer paying? And there's going to be a range. It's going to be anywhere from maybe, let's guess, we were looking at a range, and it's not like a range from 300 to 350. It's going to be on the low side 300, the high side 1200.
Right.
So that doesn't do you a whole hell of a lot of good when you're underwriting, when you have a range that big, right? And this is where this is where people miss.
Okay.
It's saying, okay, I'm going to look at that. That's important. I also want to know how often they're coming. Is this a really high occupancy type of a market? Are they coming year round? Is it more seasonal where I have to underwrite a lower occupancy for the year? Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to look at kind of my overall annual occupancy, and I'm going to factor in and say, okay, based on all this stuff I know, then I'm going to start looking at individual comps that are close to where, like in proximity to where I'm at and the properties I'm looking at, and then in proximity or in amenities and setup and all those different things. I'm going to try to find this comp set that I can comparatively look at and say, okay, I got this handful of comps that I think are pretty comparable to what I'm going to come out on the market as. And then we're going to identify, based on that range that I just showed you, where do I think the property I'm looking at is going to align? And so that I'm taking a very good educated guess on, if I'm going to say 350 to 1200, let's say I think I'm going to be toward the top of the market, but maybe not right at the top. And I'm going to be budgeting, or I'm going to analyze about $800 a month. And let's say it's an average seasonal market, and we're going to be getting about 50 to 60% occupancy. And I'm going to calculate all these numbers together and say, okay, how much total dollars am I going to be making on this property based on all that information? Then I'm going to go back and look at how much I paid for that property. Mm-hmm. What is my debt service? What are my fixed expenses? What are my variable expenses? All these different things. And usually, if you are managing the property yourself, so I'm not hiring a full service manager, I need to make somewhere around 10, 11% of my acquisition cost to break even.
Okay.
So if I buy $1 million property, I need to make $100,000 just to pay the bills.
Wow.
$100,000 a year just to pay the bills.
Wow.
If I'm managing the property myself. If I'm not managing the property myself, I need to usually be making somewhere around 12 to 13%. Mm. And so I need to be making somewhere around 120 to 130,000 just to break even.
Okay.
So all of that being said, those are a lot of steps. And you have to pull a lot of data.
Yeah.
You have to paint a lot of different pictures.
Yeah.
And you're looking at very fundamental aspects of not only the market, but the property itself, the consumer demand, all those different things to identify. You know, I might have picked a really nice property in a nice area, but what if it's not an area that consumers are spending a lot of money on? We see properties. I give an example in a workshop that I host of a property in St. George, Utah that was sent to us.
Yeah.
And the agent's like, hey, this is going to be the best property on the market. Number one property.
Oh, no.
And I looked at it. He said, man, it's in the best area.
Oh, yeah.
It's right by Snow Canyon. It's got amazing views. It's really close to Zion National Park. I looked at it. Guess what? All the things he told me were dead on. They were exactly right. But guess what the problem was?
What?
When I ran the numbers, this property lost $50,000 a year because my acquisition cost versus what the consumer was spending for those types of properties wasn't favorable as an investment. So so that's the problem where people get into trouble.
Yeah.
They're saying, hey, man, this agent, this management company said this is going to be the number one property in the market. It's going to be hitting the high water mark. It's going to be blowing everything else out of the water. Well, if you're a novice investor and you don't know how to run numbers, you're like, yeah, you're right. This is a pretty beautiful property.
Yeah.
It's got amazing views. It's right on the one of the top golf courses. It's got everything that you need as a short-term rental. The issue is I'm paying $1.3 million on a property that's going to make me $80,000. Well, that's nowhere near my break-even mark. Even if I'm managing, I need to be making $120,000 to $130,000 a year just to break even. Mm. And this one was making $80,000. Mm. And so it's looking at all of those different things and being able to run the numbers. It's our responsibility to run numbers, right? And so if I know the numbers are dialed in and I know my revenue potential is correct, then it's going to be one of the second two things, right? Now, do I design the property? Oh, yeah. You just pulled it up right there. Yeah. Put show our members. You can go to DataSense by Vodacy, your complete solution to professional STR underwriting.
Yes, sir.
So we've got our entire underwriting process for $97.
Yeah.
It's like an impulse buy.
I know.
It's like a couple coffees, you know.
There you go. I'll put it in the link in the description. Check this out. There you go. It's exactly what you need.
It's what you need. It's nothing you don't need, but it will help you run those numbers, and you can run those numbers and analyze any property in any market with all those tools. And it's the exact process we use and a training that goes along with it and show you how to break down what I just went through.
There you go.
So, and then that second piece is, listen, we're in the experience business, right?
Design.
Did you design the property?
Right.
This is where most people screw up. Yeah. Most people actually don't screw up on the numbers as much as you would think because we're in a market that continues to grow and we see people miss on their underwriting all the time, but we can there's usually potential in a market that they also didn't know, right? And so we're usually able to tap into some of that potential. What most people do is they think they're in the property business, and so they don't spend the time, they don't spend the money to understand how to pick a target audience, create a unique experience, so you're giving the consumer reason to pick you above and beyond everybody else. There's a lot of supply out there. There's a lot of competition. We talk about it all the time.
Just listen, man. Yeah. You've said this so many. Listen to this, guys.
First time you've heard this, Jake.
I know. Right? Dude.
Listen, I always am going to talk about the fundamentals. Those are the three fundamentals that we're dialing in. It's like buy the right property in the right market with the potential to make you some money.
Yes.
Set it up to create a unique experience for your specific target audience and then know how to market it to stand out. Articulate everything you have and get that consumer to say, yep, I want your property above everybody else's.
So right? why with the design? What are the problems? Why aren't they excelling with design?
People are putting together just model homes.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I just see, you should see the attempts. And I don't, this is going to sound super arrogant and I don't mean it to be. Okay. So those of you listening, I apologize in advance.
Okay.
You should see the attempts of people trying to recreate the Vodacy signature design process. And it is, it's really, really difficult for a lot of people to do. We have kind of a mad scientist within Vodacy who is super creative and understands this algorithm and it is working beautifully. It is way different than traditional home design. It's very much like color theory, consumer, commercialized type of design. It's designed to evoke certain emotions, evoke certain feelings, evoke certain like actions when people are in the property, before they go in the property, all these different things. And it's put together in this really cool cohesive design, but it's not it's not what normal designers are doing. And it's really difficult to pull off. This is not something I came up with. Mike Whitfield, our partner in Vodacy, he's the one that,
but I mean, he's the mad scientist. He's like a third generation or something, right?
He's three generations in this and very commercialized, been in the commercial design space for a long time, understands that the psychology behind that stuff, understands the scale behind what we're doing. And things you would never do in your own home. Never. Right.
But this isn't just based off a whim type thing. This isn't him just going, oh, this is my new style. I want to try this out. He's been here for three generations.
Okay. And so it's very much, this is not, hey, listen, like design is very subjective. And there's a lot of people that are putting very beautiful homes online and that you can rent out that all of us would be happy to stay in. Right. And so I'm not saying they're bad designs in the sense that nobody would enjoy them. We'd enjoy all of them.
Right.
I'm saying that it's hard to differentiate yourself from somebody else with really good design as well. And so the consumer, they all kind of lump together and the consumer, the only way that they have to judge you is price. And so you're not different enough that the consumer has. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying like all of like we have some amazing designers within our group outside of, and they're beautiful homes. Like we would all love to stay there.
Right.
I'm saying it doesn't give you enough of a differentiator to book your property for more than your neighbor who has, who also hired a professional designer to put this beautiful home together.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. If your property is going to be, you know, you said this were on the same, like close to the same plot of land with the close to the same kind of view with this beautiful, same kind of style of home, you got to differentiate in some way, especially if you can't, if you're not able to make, be the lowest price or what, you know, that quote you always say. So I go, so this could be the way you stand out against your neighbor who has the same view right there with you, with the same trees, with the same everything. This is your way. Okay. So they just don't lean into the design. Are they, it's just, they don't trust the process. What's the thing that doesn't click? Is it just, it's a lot of money. So it's a leap of faith to want to go for
it.
I think it's,
hey, listen, we're going to lean into what we're familiar with.
Right.
And so I'm going to lean into designing like I would design my own home. I'm trying to create a home away from home. That's not what people travel for. People don't want a home away from home.
Right.
You know, they want this crazy especially experience. Your home. It's different.
You know what I'm saying? Like if you're going to, if your own style, but they're not looking for what you like.
Right.
It's, I don't know.
So I think more than anything, this is a mom and pop business.
Yeah.
Most people don't get professional advice on stuff. Mm-hmm. Most people are diving into it, figuring it out. Mm-hmm. And while you figure it out, you go through and you're going to make some iterations and you're going to mess up. Mm-hmm. And I think that your first instinct is to do the things that are familiar.
Right.
And the things that are familiar to you on design are things that are going to help you blend into the crowd, not stand out and differentiate yourself.
Right. Yeah. Especially if you're looking on the OTAs and you see other things that are performing well, you just go, let's just do what they're doing. Let's just do that. All right. Next up, marketing. Did you market the property well enough? Where do people lack here?
Yeah.
They don't.
Well, marketing is three things: attract a customer, convert a customer, retain a customer.
Yes, sir. Right? Yes,
you got to be doing all of them all the time.
Yes,
sir. And when we're in the short-term rental business, we are trying to attract those consumers, stop the scroll, get them to like our property, get them to convert above and beyond, choosing us, booking our property above beyond everybody else and at higher rates, right? And so we have to give them a reason to. And this goes back to, what did we set up? What did we create for them? Yeah. And if we created something really great for them, that does 95% of the heavy lifting on the design side. The issue is I could know all about marketing. I could know everything about marketing, but if I don't have a good product that converts a customer, you know, tracks and converts, it doesn't matter what I do. So you really can't get away from doing that part that does 95% of the heavy lifting for you, because we see bad properties all the time.
Yeah.
The people think, hey, listen, I just need a direct booking site. I just need to spend some money on ads and this is going to work. No, it's not. You gotta go fix the conversion problem of having something that somebody wants and then delivering something that people are just, you know, like, hey, this was awesome. This was one of the best stays I've ever had, blah, blah. And then we take that and we just use it to articulate what we have to the masses. And we use it to showcase our properties with different types of photo shoots that we do and different, you know, we're really trying to sell the experience, not the property.
Right.
And different ways that we do that. But at the end of the day, that middle piece, designing the experience, is so critical, and it's expensive. It's one of the drawbacks of short-term rental investing, for sure. It's one of the biggest drawbacks is if you're not going to commit to that middle piece, it's going to be very, very difficult to succeed and make money in short-term rental investing. And that middle piece is a time commitment, and it's also a money commitment, because a lot of times you're going to spend more doing that than used for your down payment. And you know, so you're doubling whatever you're putting down. You might be doubling that to get these properties ready to go. And it's so it's capital intensive. It's time intensive. It can be a drain mentally, because you're doing something completely out of your wheelhouse that you might not understand or know very well. And you're trying to fight your instincts of going back to the familiar in certain types of design. But if you've got a property that's struggling, it's one of those three things for sure. Usually it's going to be that middle piece.
And then let me just add on, this isn't, I just kind of want to say, if somebody's having a struggling property, right, and they're listening to this and they go, man, this is just a leap of faith, it's a lot, then go to the website, go to our success stories page,
just check
click on one of the videos or the freaking 20 of them, click any of them to see what these people say. Honest people,
the 20, there's like 100.
Just go click on
too. There's properties too. Go the take a look. Success story page. Go look at what we're talking about. There's a whole bunch of properties that are on there that you can go kind of see, and you'll start to see some very similar things. You'll start to see some very similar concepts that are getting executed in those properties across the board, from $300,000 properties to $3 million properties. Yeah. It doesn't matter. We're doing this. We're following this same algorithm.
Mm. I love it. All right, go check that out. Go to Vodacy.com. Go to our success story page. Up next, real estate market overview. Okay, we're going to talk about turnover and renters versus homeowners net worth. Let's start with the turnover portion. Okay, there's this article here. It's in the news. You can look it up if you want. I believe they're quoting Redfin or some other kind of data analysis here, but let's just read a little excerpt here. The rate, defined as the number of homes sold divided by the total number of sellable homes, hit 2.8% in the first 9 months of 2025. So pretty much this is saying that it's 28 out of every 1,000 homes are getting a new owner, which is incredibly low, because apparently we're looking at the COVID pandemic buying frenzy. It was 44 out of every 1,000 homes had a turnover. So this is a crazy low thing, right? So now people are scared.
It's the lowest turnover in almost 30 years. And so pre-pandemic, it was like at 40 homes per 1,000. So, you know, instead of 2.8%, it was around 4%. The reason that's a big deal is because there's you know, you've got this rate lock almost, where it's locking a lot of people from wanting to move up and buy another property.
I think almost, a single family to now you're upgrading your home.
Yeah.
They don't want to do that.
Exactly. There's no real incentives, because most, I think almost 80%, 85% of mortgages in the U.S., we'll have to verify that. It's a high percentage of mortgages in the U.S. are sub 5% mortgages.
Right there. More than 70% of Americans with a mortgage have a rate below 5%.
And we're still sitting at 6-ish, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and a lot of those are in the 3 range. You know, you've got a lot of people sitting in that 3% mortgage range, right? And so there's the delta between where you're at on a fixed mortgage, and these are also fixed mortgages. These are not adjustable rate mortgages. So I think 85 or 86% of the mortgages out there are fixed rate mortgages, which means they're not moving. And so there's no risk by sitting and waiting for this stuff to happen and waiting for that market to change a little bit to where you say, hey, listen, I'm gonna wait for those rates to come back down so that I can, because right now, if you trade up a property, and you're not only trading up a property, buying a more expensive property, even if you take all your equity and put it into it, you're still putting it in another property, but you're getting double hit. You're getting hit with a higher price point and a higher interest rate.
Yep.
And so you're refinancing back out, and that delta, that payment delta, can be significant, way more significant than it is in a normal environment where you're saying, hey, listen, I'm gonna pay more, but I'm going to be roughly close to my same interest rate percentage and everything else. And so my difference in my payment is because I'm buying a more expensive house. Mm. Your difference right now, if you went straight across the board, you're going to pay more for the same property. You could sell a $1 million home, go buy a $1 million home, and it's going to cost you a lot more if you sold a 3% mortgage and then got a 6% mortgage, right? So a lot of homeowners are just saying, hey, listen,
I'll wait.
So there's this rate lock, kind of that's kind of locking down the market a little bit. And it's something to watch, right? It's the housing market is one of those things that as a buyer, we're looking at saying, hey, listen, you date the rate, you buy the property. Right. Investors, so these are this has to do with a lot of homeowners, right? These are homeowners. They're like, as an investor, use that to your advantage. You know, if the turnover rate is as low as it's ever been, what that does is it puts an artificial hold on inventory hitting the market, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't have as much inventory hitting the market. Builders have been building, and then they kind of slow down on building. Now they're saying, hey, listen, we're gonna pull back a little bit on building. So we've had this inventory gap really since the great recession back in 2010, when a lot of contractors got out of the business, like kind of the mom and pop contractors. Now the new housing market is really dominated by the major home builders, the Pulte's, the D.R. Horton's, the Lennar's, all the big guys. We're back before the bust in 2008 to 10. You had a decent amount of inventory that was local home builders, the small to mid-sized home builders. A lot of them got out of it and they didn't get back into it. Mm. We relied on these national home builders for inventory, but that supply and demand gap, it's why real estate housing prices are still really high, right? They've been holding very, very strong. And we always say you can't tell if it's a buyer's market or seller's market, because prices haven't been coming down.
Right.
Now, we could talk about prices coming down is not in, you know, I think prices skyrocketing is the solution, but prices coming down is not always the solution either. Lower rates will put a lot more money into the market because there's a lot of equity sitting in homes. There's a lot of if that delta between, you know, now when I'm motivated to put properties back on the market, there's more supply on the market. I can trade up. I'm going to be a buyer, but also a seller in a market. Those things are really healthy for the economy because it moves a lot of other industries and a lot of other businesses as well. When people can borrow against some of their equity at an affordable rate, it puts it into other industries, right? Not just home improvements, you know. You know, the toy sales, like your RVs and all that kind of stuff goes up sometimes. And so people will tap in and use that equity to go buy other stuff, investment properties, going in and tapping into the equity to go buy an investment property. And all those different things are beneficial for the economy. And I do think the rates should be coming down. I hope that they come down a little bit more than they have. I think that the Fed holding the rates where they're at doesn't make a ton of sense based on all the data they're looking at. I'm not a huge fan of how they grade and look at the data. The jobs market definitely needs a boost. And so, but everything else seems very strong. And being able to tap into a lot of that money sitting in equity in homes, I think it's at an all-time high that's ever been. I think there's $35, $36 trillion sitting in homeowner equity right now.
Yes, sir.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
We said that there's, and that's not even counting the $7.5 trillion of cash equivalents sitting on the sidelines. Like you have lower rates come down and more liquidity hit the market. Not only a lot of those cash equivalent type accounts will start to deploy into different assets and into different investments, but also you're allowing the retail buyers, the retail consumers, homeowners to tap into $35-36 trillion. Some people will be tapping into that for different things that are going to spur different areas of the economy because they can now tap into it at an affordable rate.
Okay, this is where my mind goes on this a little bit. So I'm a little tired. Remember, I'm a little tired, so stay with me. Stay with me. So my thought process as you're going, I was thinking, I feel like a couple of weeks ago we kind of touched on maybe the guy from Berkshire Hathaway started investing in homes, and then I feel like we recently talked about home builders are building bigger homes and not the smaller single-family homes. So in a long-term 5-10-year horizon, are these people thinking, okay, we know that the rates are going to drop to whatever, maybe below 5% again, these people will get that bit of courage. They'll now start buying our homes that we just built, and then the other single family person, the other people, they'll do the hand-me-down home. They'll go into those single family. Are they playing the long game?
Yeah, the big national home builders are playing the long game. I do think one that they are going to. They're thinking, hey, listen, eventually rates are going to probably come down. And we've got inventory that the buyers are going to want. And they're really the main game in town as a percentage of new home builds is the big national builders. So the big national builders are also sitting on about 2 million lots across the U.S. And so they've got a lot of land and they've got a lot of ability to go build more pretty fast. And so they're sitting on a lot of land. Now they're not all fully entitled and everything else. That means, you know, buildable ready lots.
Okay.
They're not all there, but they've got papered or entitled lots of almost 2 million lots across the U.S. That's a big number that would help the supply significantly if they start to see the buyers getting back in. They don't want to sit on a whole bunch of finished home inventory. And so they're saying, hey, listen, we'll slow down based on consumer demand. But when consumer demand starts to pick up, we'll start ramping it up. And we have the ability to because we're sitting on all these lots. So that is going to be helpful. I don't know that everybody's thinking, well, the move-up buyers are going to now put a bunch of smaller homes on the market. Maybe, maybe not. A lot of those smaller homes have turned into rentals. A lot of the small homes are not changing hands. And you're talking about what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, saying back in the 70s, they were building almost 500,000 homes under 1,400 square feet a year, right? And, and now they're building 50,000 under 1,400 square feet a year. So it's a significant reduction in home builders building small homes.
Right.
The issue is I don't think that a lot of those will hit the market necessarily as trade-up buyers move out because many of those homes have transitioned into rentals and to where people are renting those homes instead of, you know, over the years they kept them.
They stored
or an investor bought them and they're an affordable rental for a single family home. And so you'll find that a lot of those homes that were built back then are now not necessarily changing hands a lot. They're investor owned and rentals in a lot of these areas.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, was that fleshed out enough for that point? Should we go on to the next one?
Yeah, let's keep going.
Okay, so we now have renters versus homeowners net worth. We got this amazing article from CNN here. Of course, it wants to block it a little bit. Let's get out. Stand by. Here we go. So the headline is amazing. Let's just go with this. The median renter in America has a net worth of $10,400. The median homeowner's net worth is $400,000. So now I'm renting. So now I go, oh man.
You're on the wrong side of that. I feel like
I'm on the wrong side. I'm on the wrong side. So I don't understand. Are people just, they're renting right now because they just think it's better, or?
Well, let's me and you have a conversation.
Okay.
So you read that.
Okay.
I say, okay, Jake, the average, the median, the average is way more than that. The average is it's 10,000 net worth for a renter. Mm-hmm. And the average net worth for a homeowner is like 1.3 million.
Yeah.
And so the median makes it more like, okay, what's a more realistic delta? Because the top and bottom skew that so much, especially
a lot of outliers and stuff.
Yeah. And so, but let's just assume it's 40X.
Okay.
So why? Mm-hmm. Why? Like, I want to know why are you not owning a home?
Oh.
This I think is a issue in my opinion, because I'm a big believer that the average American can put themselves in a much better position financially by buying a home early. And if it's, you're paying money for rent anyway, right? And so I realize that it's more expensive to own a home right now.
Yeah.
Right. Then rent. Yeah. And that's usually the big justification.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But if you're saying, hey, listen,
bullet points down here.
You're seeing a 40X difference, and that number continues to grow. That delta continues to widen. And that's what we talk about between the haves and the have nots. And a lot of what drives that gap is owning a home and paying, like owning a home. So you're saying, okay, rent is like an adjustable rate mortgage. It goes up every year, and it can be kind of frustrating, right? Mm-hmm. You sign these leases, and all of a sudden you get these rent increases, 3-5%, and you keep going up, and all of a sudden you look back 10 or 15 years from now, and you're like, shit, I wish I would have bought back then a 30-year fixed, and I would have had a lower payment. So why are you not?
Okay. All right. So I got some bullet points here. Now I'll say, one of the main reasons is if I look at someone who's in a home right now, right? A single family home, and the 70% of Americans have a rate less than 5%.
Right.
And they're great. They have their home. Then why am I obligated to now pay a higher price with a higher interest rate? Whereas they got it at this. So I go, let me just wait. This is going to fall down at some point. At some point it's going to fall down. Now we've talked about
why?
Dude, I can.
Why you have to be watching? Why do you think it's going to fall down? Like seriously. Like, why does it have to fall down?
I think it's going to fall down because
you think the fundamentals are off.
No. I think the people who are the national contractors, I guess is the right term, they know something that we don't know, as in they're deciding to build bigger homes for a reason. They're not building smaller homes for a reason. They know that at some point rates are going to go down. People are going to go up and trade into the new homes, and other smaller people like me will just go buy those single family homes. That's why they're building it. So I go, okay, I'm just going to wait till that rate drops. Then I'll just go into that home. Plus, I don't have – my rent doesn't increase, right? So I go, I like where I live.
Your rent increases 100%.
I hasn't yet, so I'm enjoying it.
You're a fixed rent. You have a rental agreement that says you live in New York City where they can't raise your rent.
No, dude. Well, I mean, he hasn't yet, so we'll see. Maybe he may next year.
Rents can go up.
100%, it can go up. Yes, I agree.
It hasn't, but it can.
I also think
you get a 30-year fixed.
Yeah.
It can't.
Yeah. Okay, then my next point
is... Okay, but hold on. No.
Oh, okay,
no,
okay.
No, I'm not letting you off the hook. You said something that was...
Okay.
You know when you get triggered by something?
dude, we're halfway through the episode, bro.
We got
more points. Okay.
You said why...
Yeah.
Am I obligated to pay more of a rate, higher price, than somebody else?
Yeah. They're not doing it. Why do I got to do it now?
Bro, Do you know how dumb that sounds? It's when the time you get into the market, your timing of the market.
Yeah.
My grandpa bought a house for $12,000.
That's crazy, and, dude.
It, you know, I don't say, well, I'm waiting until it goes back to 12. I'm not buying a house until they go back to $12,000. I'm not doing it. Why should I have to pay more than he does?
Yeah.
You're going to, based on the time in the market. You also were 25 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bro, you know what you're going to be saying when you're my age? You're going to look back and say, dang, I can't believe I bought that house that price.
I know.
Here's the thing. I get it. It's more expensive. Yeah. I get you're looking at it, but you can't look at it and say, mm-hmm. well, I don't want to pay more mm-hmm. interest. I don't want to pay more for a house because somebody else didn't. Mm-hmm. One of my best properties that I talk about all the time is a Cherry Log property. Mm-hmm. I bought that house. The guy mm-hmm. only owned it for 8 months. Mm-hmm. He bought it for $450. Guess what I bought it from him for?
$650.
$800.
Dang, bro.
He almost doubled his money in 8 months.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who do this all the time. They look back and say, I am not. Why would I pay him $8? He just paid $450. I'll give him $600 for it. Guess what? The market value on it when I bought it was $800. And so I could just sit there and say, hey, listen, I'm not going to do that because I don't like the fact that you bought it that low. That's what you're mm-hmm. sounding like now is saying. Yeah. But here's the problem: you can't look back at markets. You look at historically, saying, hey, how can I make it work right now?
Yeah.
And lock something in right now, knowing that real estate's a very stable asset.
I believe I'm with you.
It's almost like a forced savings account. That's what that article is kind of showing is it's kind of a forced savings account that you're might be paying a little bit more into, but you're also getting the benefit of leverage, tax advantages, your note pay down on something that you're paying somebody else anyways.
Yeah.
You're paying his house payment.
Yeah.
That would drive me nuts. I would much rather look at it and say, hey, listen, I'd way rather not pay somebody else's stuff off. I'd rather pay my own. Even if I'm gonna jump my bills a little bit, mm-hmm. it's kind of like a forced savings account. Mm-hmm. You wanna be in America, there's you know, when you look at the net worth of Americans, mm-hmm. I think 90% of the stock value out there is held by 10% of the population,
US population. Dude, that's crazy.
So way heavily weighted at the top. Yeah. 10% of the people own 90% of the stock market.
Let's see.
The same, when it comes to businesses, 87 or 90% of the top 1% income earners mm-hmm. own a business, right? And so, and then like 60% of the top 10% of net worth individuals mm-hmm. own real estate.
Yeah.
And that delta between, I mean, it's hard. That's a really hard argument to say, hey, listen.
I didn't even get, that was my first point, dude.
Well, keep going. Do you have a better one? You better start with your best.
These probably are not my like amazing points here, but they're where I'm at right now. The next point is if anything happens, I just call some dude and he comes out and fixes it. If I need a new washing machine, he comes out. If I need a new dryer or need a new fridge, he comes out and fixes it. I'm like, okay, cool. If something falls on my roof, they just come out and fix it. Okay, cool. Not a problem. I love that. And the next point now, this is kind of the biggest one for me right now. And this is transparent honesty. I came from Ringgold, Georgia, bro. You could buy acreage, a pool, bedrooms, bathrooms. You can buy a lot of stuff for your money. Now I go here, I'm like, bro, what am I getting? Like, why would I be trapped into a 30-year mortgage for something like this?
Right.
Let me wait it out. I'd rather just wait because this is hard-earned money, you know? And plus, I don't like the idea of like moving around a lot. I want to own a home and like, I don't want to go.
I would think that, hey, I don't want to be tied down. I do like to move around. That's a good argument probably for saying maybe not owning. I would still buy something, rent it out and mm-hmm. move around. I do agree that there are some areas that you come from an area that you're like, man, look, I get a lot for my money out here. Mm-hmm. You come here and you don't get as much for your money, right? It's one of the more expensive areas in the country. Mm-hmm. And it is. That's difficult to look at that. However, it's also the more expensive areas in the country always have the better appreciation too. So your 5, 10, 15 year time horizon, you're going to have a much bigger gap mm-hmm. on that equity you're going to have. Like your average equity, homeowner equity in Utah is probably going to be significantly higher than the average homeowner equity in those small towns in Georgia, right? Or these areas here in Utah. And it's very regional. You could do that in Georgia too. You could take some of the top cities in Georgia or counties in Georgia versus the smaller towns and the mm-hmm. rural areas in Georgia. And that delta between ownership, even between the owners, mm-hmm. the average homeowner equity in this county is going to be a lot less than the ones in this county mm-hmm. just because of the cost of the home. So you'll make more money too. Mm-hmm. So if you can get in and squeeze into those quality assets and quality areas And now to your point of that, you think that those smaller homes, the builders are doing it. It's not because they know anything different about the market. Builders, homes
sell.
You
don't think so? Like, being like, honestly, you don't think they have any like tip? You don't think that these people don't get like any tips or anything?
Well, tips, yeah.
They, or just like they any know, like.
Okay, but listen, real estate sells price per square foot.
Okay.
So I have to pay a certain amount for a lot. Mm-hmm. I have to put the same amount of the sewer lines and everything mm-hmm. else in a lot. Mm-hmm. If I go build a 1,000 square foot home mm-hmm. and my average price is $250 a foot, mm-hmm. you know, I'm selling that home for $250,000. Mm-hmm. I still have to put on the roof. Like, a lot of your systems are all the same. I still need a furnace in there. Yeah. I still need a water heater. Yeah. I still need kitchens. Like, those rooms are not that much bigger. If I now sell that property, that same 250,000 square foot house, and I say, hey, listen, I'm going to build a 2,000 square foot home instead of a 1,000 square foot home, and I'm going to put four bedrooms in it, the cost of those bedrooms to frame out the bedrooms is insignificant to the kitchen, right? Mm. Each of them, I had to pay for a kitchen. Each of them, I have to pay for a roof. The one doubling the square footage is not doubling the size of my roof, most likely. I'm probably just going up two-story instead of one-story, for example. So I'm probably, most of my systems, I might have a little bit bigger AC, a little bit bigger furnace to push, you know, the air for the 2,000, but it's not going to be double the cost. Mm. So a lot of your baseline costs are the same, but now I can charge double the amount of money for this. So instead of selling the one for $250, I can sell it for $500,000. My lot costs me the same. My systems are roughly the same. The square footage that I'm adding is typically bedrooms or living rooms, and there's not a bunch of fixtures and everything else. It's just walls and drywall and paint and carpet, right?
Right.
And so I've built houses before. When we make decisions on building houses, a lot of times we're like, where can we add some square footage? Because we sell on price per square foot. I'd rather sell a 2,000 square foot house than a 1,000 square foot house because I make more money. My margins are better on those.
Right.
And so they're just doing it based on the economics of it. Oh, I don't think they're doing it based on
like insider knowledge.
Well, I think they have plenty of insider knowledge on stuff. But I think that at the end of the day, the cost or the reason they're building bigger and bigger homes over the years is just because the economics are better. Right?
That's interesting.
Because homes are selling on a price per square foot basis. Now they do. That's why you tend to see smaller homes sell for a larger price per square foot, a higher price per square foot, because you have a baseline like lot cost. You have a baseline systems cost in when you build a home out, and a lot of the square footage comes in some of these other rooms that you're just kind of expanding out. You have more material and everything in there, but you're not typically adding to the overall like systems and you know the roofing costs and everything else. It's not that much more for how much more square footage you're getting. Those are economic decisions.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's an interesting way. That's an interesting point you made there. Okay. I really don't know, man. I keep hearing stuff, you know, from other people online about it, and so I kind of just I'm indifferent. I really am. I
could see there's a lot of people who think they've got to come down. Prices have got to come down. I think rates are going to come down, but the minute rates come down, prices are going up.
Yeah.
And so you could build in equity right there. Right now, let's say we buy today and in the next year we see rates come from 6 to 5, maybe you start to hit the high 4s. All of a sudden, you're going to have a lot of people rushing into the market. And now all of a sudden, that 5% appreciation goes up to 7 or 8 for a year or two. Mm. That bakes in a lot of extra savings that we're talking about. Mm. You're paying a little bit more, but you're gaining it exponentially on the back end because that net worth continues to grow. So you get closer to that 400 range of net worth instead of whatever's in the savings account, you know?
Okay. Help me understand this point of the rates. If 70% of Americans are in a rate that's below 5%. And is that when you're saying fixed rate, that doesn't change. So the rate right now is like 6 point something, right? But they're locked in at that rate. Yeah. So why would people nowadays go with a rate where they can refinance? Why wouldn't they also just wait till the rates drop and then boom, lock in the fixed one?
They you can refinance anytime you want, as long as you qualify for the refinance. You can refinance.
Even with the fixed rate.
Yeah, even so you just pay for it, right? You get another loan. A refinance is essentially saying, hey, listen, I've got this mortgage out there. I'm going to call up the lender when rates drop. I'm locked in at 7% and I'm going to call my lender when rates go to 5. And that you know, depending on the size of the house, that might save me $500-$600 a month, depending on the size of the house. And I'll call my lender and say, hey, how much is it going to cost me to refinance? They're like, oh, it's going to be 1 point or 2 points of the loan. It's going to cost you $10,000. and it cost me $5,000, or I'm saving me $600 a month, so I'm saving $7,200 a year. I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll get paid back in less than a year, and I'll fix it in at 5% instead of 7% for the rest of the time. So I just replace. What they do is they pay off the first mortgage, and now you have a new mortgage at fixed. So it doesn't mean you're stuck there forever. I have a house that I have a 2.8% mortgage on.
Bro, that's crazy.
Right, it's like free money. Like that's crazy. Like it's nuts. You know,
it's ridiculous. It's
a $1.2 million house that I have a payment of like $2,200 a month. It's nuts.
Yeah, I think another portion of it is. I guess for some reason, in my mentality, I just think you should have a home when you have like kids. I guess for some reason, that's always just kind of been like a staple in my head.
Well, yeah, you're gonna be a family man. And you want to have some roots and
put, yeah.
And it's hard, so you don't want to look at a lot of those. I feel like you're stepping over dollars to pick up dimes type of a situation where you're looking at some of these things that are just a reality. Like, right, yeah. The inventory is super low. The inventory is continually, we're just talking about the turnover rate. Mm-hmm. Buyers aren't putting homes on the market. It's a good time to negotiate deals right now. Mm-hmm. And you can, right now the delta between a fixed rate and an ARM is getting pretty good. You can go get a 5-1 ARM or a 7-1 ARM or a 10-1 ARM. And that means that you got a fixed rate for 5 years and then it starts adjusting every year after that.
Wow.
But you can save. That for a long time, when rates are really low, that delta between, like, it made no sense to do an ARM because you can get a fixed rate for almost as much as an ARM. Right now, your ARM is about 0.75 to a point lower. Wow. So if you're getting fixed rates at 6%, you're paying like 5 to 5.25 on a lot of 5-1 ARMs and 7-1 ARMs right now. That's an incentive to say, hey, listen, I'll go fix my rate. I'm going to save some money. It's going to amortize faster. The note's going to actually pay down more. So you've got a lot of different options. And you got to watch all that stuff. And then you get in because you can't look and say, well, based on what somebody else paid for a house, based on what they got it for, based on what the interest rates were back in the day, I'm going to wait for it to come back. The problem with that is you could be waiting forever. And that time lost, that opportunity cost lost of having that asset that was getting paid down. And let's say you wait for 3 or 4 years and before you do something, that difference is probably $100,000 in your net worth in a small period of time. Add that gain that you're getting every single year is a forced savings. You're not spending it. It's a stable asset. You're not tapping into it.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of forcing you to save it. And then all of a sudden you sell a house and you're like, oh man, that was pretty awesome. I pulled $75,000 in a couple of years on this house. And it's like getting a bonus of $75,000 instead of if you're renting, you're never going to get that.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough, man. All right. So
hey, I'm just rooting for you.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the education. Thank you for the motivation. I appreciate it. Why are a lot of people, I didn't like the average home buyer age, like jump up like 10 years or something crazy. So is it people just can't save now, or are they also like me where they go, it just doesn't even seem worth it?
I think it's more like you. I think you're there. We're making it. Yeah. We're kind of making it one. We're not talking, like, I don't think kids your age are really talking about home ownership. It's like when I grew up, we were like me and my buddies were all talking about buying a house. I mean, I don't think you guys do that as much anymore. I think until you start to settle down and, kids are coming out and you're like, getting a little older.
Now's the time.
It went from like 25 to 35.
Yeah.
The average over what period of time? I can't remember. It was over a.
Let me try and find out.
Yeah, it's not super important, but it was over a period of time. It was short. It was like a 10 or 15 year period.
Yeah.
Was my point. It went up almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because it's kind of socially acceptable and kind of the social norm to say, why would you ever buy? Like they're making it like almost like talking you into renting. That's where I think the insider information is. That's where I think the insider, like you want to talk about what I think is. I think that they're conditioning people to not want to buy homes, which I think is a shame.
That's a really good point.
Go look at who's buying up a lot of single family homes. Like,
I will tell you, I saw another thing that kind of.
There's a lot of those big names, BlackRock, Vanguard, that own a lot of single family homes, and they're the ones. I don't know if they're the ones writing. I shouldn't say they're the ones writing the narrative, but there's a narrative out there that is. why would you ever buy? Just rent.
It's gonna exactly. Be awesome. That is the narrative, and I've heard the narrative. If you don't even really own that home, if you don't say you have a parking ticket and you don't pay it, and then you don't go to court, and then you don't do it, they're going to come to you and they're going to seize that house. So do you really own that house? Is it really yours? So you go, you don't really own either of it anyway. So
well, we started off talking about Mondami saying, if I don't like what you're doing on your rentals, I'm going to take them. We'll see how that holds up. We have pretty good property ownership rights in the U.S., and it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
You do get some of those crazy stories that you hear about, but I wouldn't use that as an excuse to sit on the sidelines.
No, just like another thing that they're kind of making you go, I guess maybe I'll just
I get what you're saying. The narrative is fed to make younger people believe that it's not that important to own a home.
Yeah.
That headline
begs
to differ.
Yeah.
And that's from, that's all over. That one was from, where was that one from? Oh, that was from CNN Business, but that's median renter.
Yeah.
10,400 net worth. Average median net worth of a homeowner, $400,000.
Crazy. All right, man. So we're at almost an hour in.
Okay, we better cut off our last topic. We went off a little bit on that one.
We're done with it. We'll come back next week.
At least it was real estate related, and that's what we want to talk about. So, okay, awesome, guys. We'll wrap up. Appreciate you sticking it out with us for almost an hour. And so we are going to wrap up today. You did good. You said you were tired today.
Damn, I'm exhausted, but hey, you couldn't even tell. People forgot.
You went one of our longer episodes. Not a problem. Awesome, guys. Well, listen, we always appreciate you spending your time with us. We know it's valuable, and we appreciate it. Our show has been growing a lot, and so you guys have been sharing it. You guys have been liking it, reviewing it on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. Those things are appreciated. I always remind you and ask you a favor to do that at the end of every episode. And it is apparent you're doing so and very, very much appreciated. The final most important thing before we wrap up, pick that one thing you can do today. Start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends. Cheers, buddy.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.